History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Every major language has a standard form and multiple dialects. In Britain, this could be the so-called Queen's English with the received pronunciation accent, and then the dialects could be Cornish or Scouse and many others. In the United States, standard English is taught in schools, and the accent is what you would hear on major broadcasters. And in Turkey, for example, the standard usage of the language is determined by the Turkish Language Foundation, but you can find dialects in the Black Sea, in the Southeast, and all over the country. But what's the difference between a standard version of a language and dialects? Dialects have different accents, but unless they're a so-called devolved version like a pidgin, they have an internally coherent set of rules that are just as solid as the standard version. Some linguists have argued that, say, Ebonics English is just as coherent as American Standard English, it's just not officially recognized. Well, what I just mentioned here is only a small part of the incredibly complex topic of human language. Somewhere between 20 and 150,000 years ago, humans began to speak. This initial Oer language evolved into the estimated 6,000 languages we have today. In today's episode, we're going to go broad and deep, and I'm joined with perhaps one of the best people to talk about the subject, Professor John McWhorter, a linguist from Columbia University. This is an episode from The Vault, and Dr. McWhorter explores language families, starting with Indo-European, which comprises languages from India to Ireland, including English. But we also ask, why are some languages related when others seem to bear absolutely no resemblance to each other whatsoever? Why is the language of the people of Kazakhstan related to the people of Hungary when Basque speakers and Spanish speakers don't speak a commonly derived language? Finally, we look at how long a language can still bear some kind of resemblance to its ancestor. In Turkey, many people argued that Native Americans have words in their languages that bear resemblance to Turkish, even though the two population groups split about 20,000 years ago, back in the Ice Age. Is this true? And if not, what does this tell us about how people view their language and what it means about their personal, ethnic, and national identity? This is a great discussion that has a lot of relevance today. And I hope you enjoy this discussion with John McWhorter. Professor McWhorter, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I imagine through your linguistic research, you've come across many different languages. And my background is that I've studied Turkish, which is quite different from English, and lived in Hungary, and I never made an attempt to learn Hungarian because it's so difficult. In your opinion, What language do you think would be most challenging for a native speaker of English to pick up based on its difference from English?
Well, that's an interesting question because there are all sorts of ways for a language to be difficult. But I would say that of the languages that we commonly have occasion to learn, the hardest one is definitely Russian. Russian is not an ordinary European language. It's got an awful lot of the case markings on the nouns and the verbal nuances that a good Indo-European language has, but it has more of it than, say, French does or even German. Then it's shot through with an awful lot of irregularity as well. And so Russian is really an accomplishment if you get good at it. But in terms of languages of the world, the ones that are really, by any stretch of the imagination, harder than what we're used to, There are certain few that I often think about. One of them is Navajo, which is one of the Native American languages spoken in the United States. It's interesting. Even the specialists on Navajo never put this in so many words, but Navajo doesn't have any regular verbs. Basically, in Navajo, every verb has to be learned by rote. Its forms change according to what we roughly would think of as tense and mood. And the forms really are just different for each verb. And so for about 8,000 different verbs, you just sort of have to know. And there's some rules of thumb, but only that. And really, to know Navajo is to have mastered more irregular verbs than we can imagine a language ever having. So that always impresses me. And that's true of Navajo. And of course, Navajo has many relatives, and you know, they're all like that. Then there is a language spoken in Siberia that is near dead at this point called Ket. And Ket is not really closely related to any language nowadays, although actually there's a theory that's gaining traction that it's related to Navajo. But Ket is different from Navajo in terms of its complexity, but still, it's got so much irregularity and just so many bells and whistles that you have to attend to say anything at all, that I find it hard to imagine any human being who wasn't an obsessive really learning to speak it if they didn't learn it from childhood. It's interesting that way. And then finally, this is also not talked about very much, but it's one thing to learn Mandarin Chinese. It has four tones, and that's hard enough if you're going from English and you're not used to tone. But Cantonese is not just, quote-unquote, a dialect of Mandarin. Mandarin and Cantonese are about as different as Spanish and Italian, really more. And Cantonese has six tones. If you want to make it sound more impressive, you can squeeze it and say nine. Really, it's six, but that's hard. To really learn to speak that language well, if you don't grow up bathed in it every day, is a massive feat. And there are other languages in Southeast Asia that have really as many as eight tones. If you know anybody who speaks Hmong, in the United States we meet Hmong immigrants. That person speaks a language where you have to know the difference between eight singing levels in order to just utter a sentence. And that's, of course, every word in the sentence. So yeah, languages get much harder than the learning various tables of endings that challenges us in Spanish or even Latin. Languages are cooler than we often think from our Western European perspective.
That sounds horrifying to me. I always thought that I had it bad as a Turkish speaker when I learned Turkish because it's agglutinative, which for listeners, the, yeah, there's suffixes stacked on top of verbs because of its difference from English. But it's so logical a language compared to what you described, where you almost can't learn it unless you're born into it. Why do you think some languages like that, like Navajo or Ket, are so unsystematized versus modern languages like in Indonesia, where there's almost no exceptions? What correlates with the structure of a language to a culture?
Yeah, it's interesting. The languages that are really, really nasty and ingrown in that way, and nasty, of course, is not a qualitative judgment, just hard to learn from the outside. Those languages are the ones that very few adults have ever had to learn. What's crucial here is that children can learn just about any language that you throw at them. They don't have much else to do. Their brains are extremely plastic, and they have years and years of experience of taking in the language under those conditions. And so a child can learn something much, much, much more complicated than English's grammar. And by the time they realize how complicated it is, if they ever do, they've already learned it. So when a language is that complicated, it's a sign that adults have not had to learn it, except maybe under school-type conditions. And so Russian and Polish and the other Slavic languages are very, very hard. But Russian, of course, has been mastered by countless people as a second language. But that's largely in the context of school and literacy and media, where you can sort of pound it into people. But for the most part, language becomes awesomely complicated when only babies are learning it. And so, for example, Turkish. From English, Turkish, with all those piles of suffixes, can feel very intimidating. We're not used to so much information being packed into those short little bits. But the truth is, as you've noticed, Turkish has a certain logic. Turkish has a certain tidiness. As languages go, Turkish is actually not that hard from English or really from any other language. And that's because that is a language that has been spoken by great many people as a second language since time immemorial. If you look at some of the Turkic languages that are not like that, that have not been used by as many adults as by children, then what you find are basically what are Turkish but hard, which is not something that you encounter when you learn Turkish itself. So yeah, it's about adult acquisition. Adult acquisition is what makes a language like English. For English, it was Vikings who did this to our language starting in the 700s AD. And in any language like English, where things seem to make a certain basic sense, at least at the beginning, when things are this user-friendly, always that means that there's some sort of interruption in the social history of the language, usually before literacy and print. And the odd thing is that for you and me, something like English feels normal. We think this is the way a language is supposed to be. Then we see a Navajo or a Ket, and we say, well, why is that language so complicated? Really, those are the normal ones. And the question to ask is, why are English and Turkish so relatively user-friendly? And the answer to that is social history.
Well, let's get back to the beginning of that social history. And in your research, you've talked about the origins of language, which has one of the most intriguing questions, and it finds itself into all sorts of narratives of religion, the Tower of Babel and elsewhere. And one thing that you've mentioned is that there was a single spoken tongue 150,000 years ago from which evolved the 6,000 languages today, approximately. So I don't know how well you can condense this, but what's the story of language from this period in time immemorial down to our situation we find ourselves now?
Well, we can be pretty sure that the languages of today trace back to a single original one. I've noticed that some people seem to find it attractive to imagine that language arose many times. And I think that's partly because people like the conception of diversity, partly because it would make for, in a way, a more interesting story. But economically, given that we seem to be genetically specified in some way to speak, given that we've never encountered or ever heard of any human groups that had not developed the capacity for speech, it seems that Homo sapiens, part of what made the package was speech, or that it emerged in early Homo sapiens and then just took off. And after that, what happens is simply the game of telephone. So after there are a certain number of people, they're likely going to split into groups because it'll be easier for both to survive. And once one group goes off, as time goes by, sounds start drifting along. What once was an ah will become an aw, will become an oh, will become an ooh. Imagine that happening to every sound in the language gradually over time. You start using words in different kinds of meanings so that after a while you don't even recognize what the original meaning was. The word generous in English first meant noble. And then if you're noble, then presumably you are munificent to your subjects. And after a while, generous came to mean magnanimous. Now we find it hard to imagine it referring to something like nobility. Imagine that happening to every word in the language and other sorts of changes so that after a while, and it's a long while, those two groups aren't speaking anything that they could communicate in. Humans spread all over the world. And so in each place, that original flame developed in different directions. And next thing you knew, you had today's 6,000 languages. It's possible that there once were more languages than that, because we live in a time when, because of geopolitical history, a certain few languages have managed to be spoken all over the world, especially certain Indo-European languages like English and French and Portuguese. Then there's the success of Russian and Arabic and Indonesian. There are a big 20 languages, including several in India, some of which we haven't even heard of, that are spoken by massive numbers of people. But before that was the case, and it's technology that largely has allowed that over the past couple of millennia, or especially since the Neolithic, but especially over the past couple of millennia, there probably were more languages than 6,000, because you would have had a bunch of little groups of people largely existing on their own, and everybody would have their own language. So that's how you get from one to several, because language can't stay the way it is. Language doesn't change only because different cultures come together. It doesn't change only because, although this is a popular idea, that groups like to sound different from one another. It's kind of like cloud formations. Language just drifts. So even if you had a bunch of people who were living together in a cave, and for some reason they did that for 1,000 years, no cultural developments, they don't meet anybody else, nothing changes, they would come out of the cave speaking a different language just because language is always ooching along through a series of quiet misinterpretations and transformations into becoming what will eventually be some other language just because that's the way it is. So that's why there's 6,000 languages now, whereas at some point there almost certainly was only one.
There's a really attractive idea that's taken hold for people for millennia that we all spoke this one language in the Genesis account before the Tower of Babel, that we spoke, I guess the medieval and classical idea would be Hebrew in the Garden of Eden. And then due to our hubris, God causes our languages to change. And I don't know about other religions and if there are stories like the Tower of Babel, but what do you think intrigues people so much about this idea about all of us speaking one language at some point in the past. Why is that so attractive?
I think that people like that idea because the truth is, and it's odd for me to say as somebody who makes part of his living on the diversity among languages, the truth is, I say this always worried that certain people in linguistics and anthropology are going to have me struck down for saying it. But the truth is, if there were only one language, if language were not inherently mutable and it just stayed the way it was and everybody on Earth spoke variations on one language and could understand one another, I don't think many people would be spontaneously saying, I wish there were 6,000 different languages and that we couldn't understand one another because that would be fun in terms of diversity. Nobody would wish for that, which means that as interesting as different languages end up being once that situation sets in and languages extend their tendrils into culture and there's a kind of symbiotic relationship between the two, etc., and you start to notice that languages end up differing from one another in fascinating ways, the truth still remains that all of that diversity is also very much of an inconvenience. Imagine how much easier life would be. And I don't necessarily mean there would be no wars. We can assume that there would be. But there would be a major convenience in there not being all these different languages. And the ancients knew that. You know, our cherishing of diversity is a wonderful thing in many ways, but the ancients did not tend to cherish it the way we do. And the reason that the Babel tale is ancient is because for them, the idea that there were all these different languages was a curse. You went over the hill and you couldn't talk to people. And it didn't exactly help you to not want to have a war with them. For them, that was a nuisance. And so that's why the Babel story is that way. And I think all of us deep down like the idea that we could all communicate in one language, even if I think today we think that we hope everybody would also have their own private languages to learn.
Let's chart the history as it goes on. So language emerges from somewhere in Western Africa, and it follows humanity as it spreads out to Eurasia and elsewhere. Is there any sense of what some of the oldest language families are? Would it be Semitic or something else?
Well, that's dangerous territory.
Yeah, I would imagine all these ethno-centered theories from the 1800s. Yeah.
And even today, it's hard to say because we're talking about 150,000, or these days, people are more likely to say about 200,000 years. And all it means really is even if you just get in a helicopter and sail over all of the sensitive, you know, socio-political issues that are connected with these things, language keeps changing to such an extent that any language today will have changed so much since 200,000 years ago that in no sense can we say that it's the same language. But it's a reasonable guess that the languages, well, you said West Africa, I very gently correct you to East Africa only because I'm going to say now, languages spoken.
Oh, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, East Africa kind of drifting a little southerly. Those languages could well be the descendants of the original language simply because that appears to be where humanity arose. And if humanity started speaking pretty quickly, then that's where things would be. Now, there have been a great many migrations. It could be that the original people were all, you know, wiped out at some point. But the fun fact that one wants to use, and the specialists in these languages bristle when you say this because we can't be absolutely sure, but the fun fact is that the Click languages, which are three families of languages that are spoken in southern Africa at this point, with a couple of them spoken in East Africa, those possibly could be the descendants of the first language. It could be that the first language had those clicks in it, so that the question is not why does a language have clicks in it, but why the other languages lost them. So that could be. We may never know, but I think it's almost certain that the first language was spoken in Africa. Now, maybe it was first spoken after humans moved somewhat upwards, in which case maybe there's a case that what are now the Semitic languages are descendants of that first language, and then language spread back down to Africa if Semitic was in the Middle East, which is not certain at this point. Most economically, though, the first language was spoken in Africa, and it may be that the Click languages are the descendant of that first language, although there may not have been clicks in it yet.
Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. But first, I want to give a shout out to all the other great shows on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including Beyond the Big Screen. And you can find this and many other great shows at ParthenonPodcast.com. Something I've seen a lot of interest in are primordial connections between languages that are far away from each other now. And you mentioned possible connections between the Ket in Siberia and the Navajo. One thing I heard in Turkey, this is a really crackpot theory, but that there are words in different American Indian languages that correspond to Turkish, because Turks love the idea that they're anciently related to American Indians because they're from Central Asia. The American Indians originally came from that area, so they have this ancient kinship connection. And this goes back to ethnocentral or nationalistic histories from the 1930s that were all Turkish if you dig down far enough. But there is a recent connection, and I'd like to hear more about this, between an obscure language of Nepal and the language family of Papua New Guinea, which some date back to 75,000 years of a relationship between words. Can you tell me about that?
There is evidence that's been discovered of one language that's spoken up in Nepal, you know, up technically above India, and then some languages that are spoken on the island of New Guinea. And the connections seem to be too idiosyncratic to be accidental. And it's just a few words. And if we were talking about very broad similarities, well, accidents happen. But in these cases, we're talking about specific concepts with rather specific shapes. And so it appears that there's some connection between this one language called Kusunda in Nepal, which is close to extinct at this point, and then certain languages spoken a very, very long distance away, which suggests that some parallels between languages can persist for tens of millennia. Now, most people who study language change vigorously insist that that could not possibly be true. And even if you're somebody who's relatively open to the more adventurous ideas such as me, truth is, once you get beyond about 10,000 years, you do expect that any kind of relationship is going to start to become extremely vague. And for it really to be as much as the 60 or maybe 75,000 years that you have in that case that we're talking about, it is a stretch which makes you think that maybe there was some more recent migration that we don't know about, that it doesn't stretch that far back. But in general, I think that the people who traditionally study language change are almost athletically skeptical of any connection between distant languages that isn't based on something like the beautiful charts that you can make for the connection between, for example, Latin and Russian, where it's just painfully clear. If you can't do something like that, there's a certain kind of historical linguist who simply just won't listen. And I think it's partly because they're not interested in something where the case isn't that strong, because you just don't have as much data to work with. It's harder to write a real paper about it. But if you have a slightly more romantic, I mean, hopefully intelligently romantic, but romantic sense of things, you want to know about connections further back. And Russian historical linguists in particular are more open to the idea that we can go further back than, say, just the ancestor of most of the languages of Europe and Iran and India, Proto-Indo-European. They want to say that Proto-Indo-European itself can be traced back to this other language that was the grandfather of Proto-Indo-European and other groups. Under that analysis, it is possible that you could find ties between Turkish and certain languages spoken by Native Americans today. There are people who would not call that absolutely crazy. What evidence the Turks you've talked to are using for that, we'd have to talk about what it is, because, you know, they probably are not in a position to know the difference between idiosyncratic correspondence and accident. The truth is that you can take a list of about, well, you, I can take a list of about 15 words in English and 15 words in Japanese and say, look, all of these words line up almost perfectly. This shows that there must have been some relationship between the language that arose on the island of Britain and the language now spoken in Japan. And of course, there's no significant relationship at all by any stretch of the imagination. And so all of those words that I could line up, such as taberu, which means to eat and looks like our word for table, that they have a word inki, which means gloomy and is kind of like our word for inky, you know, it just kind of goes on and on. It's an accident. So you have to distinguish that. So if somebody from Turkey says, well, look at these dozen words and the words are exactly the same in Apache, that's not going to cut it. You need a better case than that. But I wouldn't require them to have as good a case as some people would. I would go with a certain Russian kind of perspective on this.
You called it. That's exactly what it is, where a newspaper will show, here's 20 words in Turkish. Here's 20 words in Cheyenne. And look how they you called it. Well, this has really interesting implications. If languages can change into almost something completely different over a period of time. And that goes into a different structuralist theory from the mid-20th century, Claude Levi Strauss, that society is a structure. It's not linked to some sort of transcendent truth like pre-Enlightenment or Enlightened people would say. And what these people would say is that the structuralist is that language determines the way we perceive the world. And what do you make of that as a linguist?
Well, that idea that the structure of your language shapes your thought is deeply attractive. I mean, anybody wants to believe that. There are all these languages, there are all these people. Wouldn't it be neat if the Burmese language channels what it is to be Burmese in the mind? And that's been proposed by some people, usually on the basis of one language at a time. Now, of course, a language can express concepts local to its culture, certainly. But if we want to take it further and say that the structure of the language, how its verbs pattern, what sorts of concepts it splits things up into, whether it has several different words for water instead of one, to say that all of that is correlated with culture is simply dangerous. And I wrote a book about it called The Language Hoax, because I've noticed that a lot of people who are interested in the subject don't always seem to perceive the possible insult in the whole notion. And so, for example, people like to talk about how, say, Russian. In Russian, you can't just say blue. They have one word for dark blue, one word for light blue. And one wants to take from that that they, therefore, are more sensitive to grades of blueness than we are. And if you can look at a Native American language, they tend to have markers for nuances of existence that we wouldn't think of. There'll be, you have to, when you say a sentence, you have to indicate whether the thing you're talking about is round or long or straight. There are languages in New Guinea where you have to specify what time of day something happened, not just whether it happened in the past or the future. It's easy to look at something like that and say, okay, they're more sensitive to those sorts of things. Their language is channeling their thought. And we also want to say those things about indigenous groups because there's a justifiable part of any educated Westerner that wants to show that we understand that humans are all cognitively equal. We do not look at most of the world as primitives. Problem is, take a language like Chinese, Mandarin Chinese, or really any Chinese, or really, frankly, most languages of East and Southeast Asia. They're very telegraphic. You have to say much less in the typical sentence in Mandarin than you do in English. There are no articles. You don't have to mark a verb for tense. It's a very brief language in terms of learning how to express yourself. That's also true of Japanese. So if in those languages they take it lighter than a European language in terms of how much of life you have to acknowledge when you express a sentence, well, based on this paradigm about language and thought, you have to say that those languages channel their thoughts more dimly than our patterns in English do, or that the patterns in something like Russian does. To really embrace that idea that language shapes thought is, unfortunately, to call everybody who grows up speaking Chinese a little bit dumb. You know, not too dumb, but just not as sharp as a European or a Native American. And that's because a great many languages are more telegraphic than others, for reasons often due to chance. So the whole paradigm there is very dangerous. I think it's very popular. Books that espouse it tend to sell very well because it's a handy way for us to show that we don't look down on other people. But it's also a way of, unfortunately, insulting a great many people while you think that you're being the good Westerner. So I really exhort people to be very careful about that idea that language channels thought, despite that even when I say language channels thought feels good, we want that to be true. But luckily, though, given what languages are really like, it isn't.
One example of this, and you'll have to forgive me because I don't have the notes in front of me for this group, so I'll have to stumble toward my question.
That's okay.
There was a missionary in the 1980s in South America who encountered a tribe that he claimed basically could only describe empirical reality. They didn't really have the language for the subjunctive voice to describe hypotheticals or things that weren't around them. They were the ultimate positivists. They could really only describe what they directly encountered and nothing else. And do you know what I'm talking about here?
I do.
Could you first describe this better than I did? And then whether you agree or disagree with this former missionary's theory.
Well, yeah, this is Dan Everett, who is a linguist and a very good one. And he was not the only person. There was also a psychologist, Peter Gordon, who analyzed the Piraha, who are a small group of Amazonians. And this hit the media in particular in the aughts. And the idea was that, one, these are people who essentially only live in the present tense, and that, two, their language channels that, and that the language reinforces the way they are. And the controversy over this has been absolutely fierce. And so very briefly, Everett has argued, for example, that the Piraha don't have subordinate clauses. They don't have relative clauses. So they won't say, the man who I saw. They'll say, there's a man, I saw him. Or they won't say, the woman said she had another piece of fruit. They'll say, there's a woman, she said something, she has another piece of fruit. His idea is that if you're just living in the present, you're not going to nest your thoughts together in ways like that that suggest that you're looking back or looking ahead. Now, the truth is that if you look at the battle between Everett, who viscerally I support, and his detractors, who are fierce, narrow, Noam Chomsky, generative syntax addicts, who viscerally, I think, are on the wrong track in most of their work. Truth is, they won. I think that Piraha does have relative and subordinate clauses. Or the idea, what really got around in the media, is that Piraha doesn't have any numbers. So you can argue maybe that they have one and two, but even there, not really. They don't count. And the idea that got around was that the reason that they can't do math is because they don't have numbers, which is one of the silliest things I've ever heard. Of course, if they don't have numbers, they can't do math. But they don't have numbers because their lives didn't lead them to need to be able to do math. And so the idea is not that their language is channeling their thought and their orientation towards the world. Their culture, which is enumerate, naturally has an effect on the language, and therefore they can't do math because they don't have numbers, which is different from saying they can't do math because their language doesn't have words for 1, 2, 3, and 4. They don't have the concepts of 1, 2, 3, and 4. So Piraha is a very interesting case. It's a very different culture from ours. Cultures certainly differ. But the idea that the language tracks with the culture in any way we would consider significant isn't there. And so, for example, yes, the culture is enumerate, so they don't have numbers. Who would guess that they would? If they're enumerate, why would they have a word for 14? But the idea that they're highly presentist, which they very well may be, and therefore they don't have relative and subordinate clauses, that gets dicey. One is suspicious. That aspect of Everett's claims has not really held up very well.
Would you say that with language, necessity is a mother of invention? And if this tribe did grow to a few hundred and maybe developed rudimentary technology, then they would develop the words for these concepts?
Of course. And I mean, it's been shown. You know, there are many groups in the world that don't have any numbers. None of them are walking around using computers and having libraries. All of them live very close to the land. And so, oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Noam Chomsky, and he's somebody that, it's good to bring them up if you know nothing about linguists, because you know that if I need to virtue signal as an intelligent person, I reference him, even though I have no idea what he said. I don't know why Noam Chomsky is, but whatever. So, but one right. of his arguments is that language, the use of language, is innately specified in the human brain. So where do you stand on this?
Chomsky's wrong. And
there we go.
Frankly, you know, you say that in some circles and you're told that you're not bright enough to understand the jargon that they use, or that you just don't understand the question. But I've been thinking about this for years, and they have built a very interesting theory complete with a massive jargon and framework and, you know, certain diagrams that you would barely recognize as having to do with language, based on this idea, not that our ability to speak is inherited, which almost nobody doubts. It's clear that there's some sort of genetic specification for speech that we have that even the most sophisticated other primate doesn't. But the idea that it's the very elaborate ingrown mechanism that the Chomskyans have developed really is falling apart ever more every 5 years. And what they've come up with is so abstract and so abstruse that it's virtually impossible to communicate it to the general public, which is a sign that something's wrong. Because, you know, maybe language is that complicated. But frankly, you know, it's one thing for mathematics to be that complex or astrophysics. Language doesn't need to submit to analysis that complex. And so I think that they've gotten caught up in something where certainly they're not going to give up. Nobody wants to admit that they're devoted to something that doesn't work out. But there is no scientific reason to assume that language is as disconnected from basic cognition as they would like to think. Now, Noam Chomsky got modern linguistics started by giving us a certain perspective on what it is to form sentences and making us realize what a miracle human language actually is. But if you actually opened up a journal full of the kinds of articles that Chomskyans are trained to write, what you would see is this notion that human speech, what you and I are doing right now, is generated on the basis of something that looks more like the way you would work out organic chemistry or differential quotients or a very elaborate computer program. And the empirical evidence for it just isn't there. So I would have to say that. However, I should say that people smarter than me who are generative syntacticians in the Chomskyan tradition would assume that what I just said was based on a kind of willful ignorance. I imagine they would make a rather articulate case for themselves, but they couldn't describe to you how their work works, because what they come up with is abstract, as I said, beyond what you can even communicate to anybody outside of the, you know, roughly 1,000 people who work in that paradigm. And as I say, that alone smells bad. So we'll see what happens.
Right. If your theory of communication can't be communicated with words, then it's a snake eating its own tail of incomprehensibility that
I highly suspect. Yes. Right.
Well, let's look more into the modern era. I remember from the mid-1990s, there was a lot of controversy about the teaching of Ebonics in schools, mm-hmm. of Black English. And this is fascinating, because this is all these different theories we're talking about in language. It's really here in practice, and it's, I guess, educators trying to deal with what they see as a living, evolving, organic expression of language. So what's the nature of this dialect, if you perceive it to be a dialect, and where did it come from?
Ebonics, which is usually by academics called African-American Vernacular English, I prefer Black English, is one of many different strains of English, just as there are a great many in Great Britain, and there are different ways of speaking English among non-Black people in the United States. And just as Cockney English is not somehow worse than the English that they speak on a TV show like The Crown, it's just different. English developed differently among those people in that neighborhood. Black English is not, as most people think, a degradation of what English is supposed to be. It's not a broken English. It's just different. And that can be really hard to perceive, because it is a spoken rather than a written form of English, because it is spoken in contexts that are not elite. And then, of course, because it's spoken by a group of oppressed people, it's all of those things together. But it actually is every bit as fluent and nuanced and complex as any kind of human language. And actually, in one of my recent books, Talking Back, Talking Black, I try to get across that Black English, as broken as it understandably can sound, would actually challenge a Martian just as much as standard English would if somebody had no idea. So that's what Black English is. The Ebonics controversy, which I cannot believe is now 20 years ago, very interesting, because the idea was that Black students are failing in school partly because they grow up with Black English and then they're confronted with this alien standard English code at school. So the suggestion was that educators make some sort of transition between Black and standard English by doing translation exercises, by focusing on Black English, and by also just not denigrating Black English in the classroom. And people weren't terribly specific about exactly what they wanted to do, but the idea was to bring Black English into the classroom and treat it as something respectable, not to teach in it. So everybody loved the idea that what was being proposed was that teachers be up at the blackboard speaking jive. That's not what anybody wanted. But the idea was that Black English was some sort of barrier to educational success. I actually, you know, got into hot water with a certain contingent for the first, although by no means the last time, when I said that, no, Black kids are having trouble in school for a whole different set of other reasons equally connected with injustice, but it's not because of the differences, which are rather small, between Black English and standard English. And I said it's an insult to think that students who frankly have grown up hearing as much standard English as Black English in their lives are so confused by those differences that that's why they're having trouble with, for example, learning how to read. It's really more the things that we hear about all the time, about the nature of the schools themselves and the problems with the students' lives. But I wasn't supposed to say that. There was a sense within the linguistics community that you were supposed to say that Black kids are being deprived of their rights as bi-dialectals. And, you know, the debate is now 20 years ago. All the, you know, the feathers are no longer flying. And the truth is, I think that to the extent that people are learning how to get education across to kids from difficult homes of whatever color, they're seeing that the dialect translation is not necessary. However, this was something that I think people found hard to get from what I was saying back in the late 90s. Black English is legitimate speech. So my issue is not Black English is trash and therefore shouldn't be used in the classroom. It is legitimate speech. It's worthy of study in its own right. But I think there are other things we can spend money on to help poor Black kids learn than pretending that what they're confused by is that the way people speak in their neighborhood is slightly different from the way some of their teachers speak at school.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Well, it gives us a living example of this process we've been talking about, this multi-millennia process of languages evolving and changing within a culture. But to sort of wrap up some of these things, or to begin to, I suppose, how do languages die?
Well, languages die when they aren't passed on to just one generation. Because as we've said, languages are best learned in the cradle. Some languages really can only be learned in the cradle. So all it takes is one generation that doesn't do that and instead speaks some other language into its children's cradles. And the language is in serious trouble, especially because only about 100 languages, maybe 200 at the most, are written in any real way. You and I think of language as a written thing because that's what we grew up with, English and, you know, highly educated circumstances. Most languages are just spoken. And so if you're speaking one of those languages where if anybody's ever written it down, it was, you know, somebody translated the New Testament or there are a few kids' books or something like that. Once you have a whole generation who don't really speak it, how are they going to learn it? You know, there is no Rosetta Stone, and if there was, Rosetta Stone doesn't work very well. And there's nothing written, so you can't learn it from the page. Let another generation go by, and you're really in trouble, because that means that people maybe 80 who are slowing down and have other things to do, they speak it. But then again, were they trained as language teachers? And the typical layman can teach you some words and some expressions. But imagine most of us, even if we got really good at Spanish, teaching it to somebody else. You need training to be a language teacher. And teaching your native language, you or me teaching somebody how to speak English from the ground up with the idea that they really were going to use the language conversationally, it's hopeless. So languages die when a certain big Berlitz set of languages, as I call them, although that term is getting a little old-fashioned, end up taking over people's lives. And within people's lives, that can seem quite logical, because languages aren't just codes, they're associated with social concepts. And if English is the language associated with financial success, with the cosmopolitan, with pop music that you want to listen to, with the wider world, you might end up preferring English or some kind of English to whatever that tiny language is that your parents speak, especially if your father speaks one thing and your mother speaks another. So languages die, and they die a lot more now than they used to. Because let's say that you're in Tanzania, you're from a small village, you speak a language nobody's ever heard of, you marry somebody from another small village who speaks another language nobody's ever heard of, you move to Dar es Salaam, you're in the city. The language that you two communicate in is Swahili, which is one of the big dude African languages that happens to have wound up in the shop window. That's what you speak to each other. When you have kids, what are you going to speak to the kids? The kids you're going to speak to in Swahili, because that's what you speak in with each other. And if you were going to use those two tiny languages in the home, and you might, really, how much is it going to happen when only one of you speaks that language? And is your child really going to embrace that language when they're going to grow up in the city where Swahili is the language that's everywhere and is the language that they use in school? And then, of course, on top of Swahili, English is all over the place. So what that means is that the kids aren't going to speak those tiny African languages. Now, suppose it gets to the point that a great many young people from those two villages are going to Dar es Salaam, and there are only a few people left behind. And even there, people are beginning to embrace Swahili instead of the local languages because they associate the village with being backwards, or there's some environmental problem and nobody wants to be in the village anyway. That's happening to languages all over the world. And so it's said that at the end of this century, probably there'll only be about 600 languages left. And I think that that is a realistic estimate. So, you know, Finnish and Korean will be fine. But for example, Ket that I talked about, that language is, you know, on its last legs, even a language like Navajo. Because unless you keep on passing it on to people in the cradle, nobody can learn 8,000 irregular verbs, or not well. And so nobody will speak anything like Navajo as it actually was. So yeah, there's a language death problem. And I think in many cases, what we have to do is just at least document what these languages were like, because after a certain point, and this is something where I have to tread lightly, there are people who are making major efforts to revive languages like those in Australia, here in the United States, and all over the world. And the last thing I want to do is seem like I'm throwing a cold bucket of water on those efforts. But truth is that if only people 80 speak the language, the chances that you're going to have a new generation of people living and loving in that language and passing it on to their own kids are very, very small. And so often what those efforts are most valuable for is documenting the language before nobody speaks it at all. And that's a sad situation, but that's the way it seems to be in a grievous number of places in the world.
Well, I'd like to tie these things together by asking you about the future. I've seen things about Google Glass, these, you know, augmented reality devices that can input text upon you. And the thing that people always talk about with this technology is instantaneous translation. And a lot of the work Google has done with Google Translate and using deep learning to have more accurate translation, futurists and journalists always like to say, oh, in the future, you will go to France and you will get instantaneous translation. You speak in English, they see the text in French, and vice versa. So if this technology gets really good and there's machine learning, almost instantaneous translation, conceivably, could someone from southeastern Turkey who speaks Syriac, which is a dying language, spend the rest of their life speaking Syriac, and even their Google Translate Google Glass, if they become a pilot, will give them landing instructions in Syriac? That would be probably pretty convoluted. Or a Ket speaker can become an auto mechanic, and I don't even know how you translate carburetor into Ket. I'm sure that'd be, you know, fun.
It would be some work. sounded like.
Like the way with the code talkers, the Navajo, their terms for B-29 were turtle or whatever. So I don't know. Do you think technology could somehow keep alive these things that are languages are on their last legs?
It's a thought. I mean, part of the problem is that how do you feed into what the computer needs to do the translation, and what's being used, and this is awesome technology in itself, is massive amounts of text. Now, if you're talking about a language where there never have been and never will be massive amounts of text, and what you can feed it is sentences and words and expressions, you're never going to have very good translation abilities. And so I'm not sure how it's going to work for Ket. Syriac is a good example because that's a dialect of Aramaic. We associate that with Jesus and we assume that it's dead. Aramaic actually exists in a couple of dozen very different dialects that are essentially different languages scattered throughout the Middle East and beyond. But most of those are dying at this point, and a lot of them were never really written down in any real way. But if you're talking about, say, the big 500 or so languages that are going to be left, yeah, we're getting to the point where translation at a certain level of interaction is just not going to be necessary. It won't be necessary for documents. The whole idea that you go somewhere and you have to learn to speak the language to get a hotel room in the old Berlitz books, that's going to be completely over. I mean, there are two things. One, more and more people are just going to speak English, and that's sad in a way, but it's also true. But then also, instant translation will mean you don't have to work as hard. Now, to have relationships, I may lack imagination. This is one of those things where, you know, I might be being laughed at when somebody listens to me saying this 100 years from now. I don't know that these programs are going to get so good that you can actually translate the full nuanced humanity of a person speaking fluently and casually. I'm guessing that if you are really going to exist in Japan as an English speaker, even 100 years from now, there will be a reason for you to learn to speak Japanese from your own brain. But it's going to be a very different landscape from what we know. I honestly think that the whole idea that you need to learn to speak a different language in classes from middle school on, that you need to take a Spanish class in college, I think that's going to become unnecessary. People are going to kick and fight, but I'm saying this as a linguist and as a lifelong language fan. That's not going to be as necessary because technology is going to obviate the need for it. But I think that there will persist hundreds of languages at least, and you're going to need to learn them if you want to actually spend time in the language and among its people. But it's going to be only then that you need to learn other languages. Very different from what we're used to.
So, bad for Berlitz, good for linguists.
Pretty much.
Because it's good news in a way. Great. Well, I could go on for a lot longer because I'm so curious about this topic of languages. But I appreciate all the things that you mentioned. This just, I think, gives people a fascinating vista into the world of languages and what it means for culture. And your course on the great courses is called The Story of Human Language. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. And I'll include a link for this if people want to follow up with the course and learn more about it. Dr. McWhorter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.